God,
grant me the
serenity
to accept the things I cannot change. The courage to change the things I can. And the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. All right, the Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anybody here tonight in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. You're free to unmute yourself, introduce yourself, raise your hand, make yourself known. Anybody?
Hi, I'm Siobhan.
Hi, Siobhan. Welcome. Glad you're here.
Hi, I'm Molly, first 30 days.
Molly, welcome. Glad you're here.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jody. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jody. Welcome.
Hello.
Oh, this is wonderful. So glad you're here. So if you would like your number passed along to the newcomer,
Honey,
please.
Do you want some?
If you would like your number passed on to the newcomer, please send that to one of the hosts. And we'll pass it on. All right, let's see. I am going to now disallow people from unmuting themselves. The preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous states that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we are very excited to have Chris S. come tell his story. After he shares, we'll take a short break. At top of the hour, we'll call for a few announcements, Seven Tradition, et cetera. And then we'll have the opportunity to reconvene and ask Chris some questions. Please feel free to send a question through the chat to the user questions, which is really Larry. So Chris, really looking forward to hearing you tonight. Thank you so much for coming. And I don't want to take up another minute of your time. I give you Chris S.
David, thank you very much. Hi, everybody. My name is Chris. I am an alcoholic. I'm very, very grateful to be in Virginia. A little story about one of the things that I experienced in Virginia. This was about 11 years ago. I was invited down to this thing called a Sober Fest. And what it was this giant outdoor event with a big stage, and it was music and all kinds of stuff. And they had a couple of speakers thrown in there. And I was one of the speakers. Now, I'm going to speak at 1 o'clock in the afternoon or something. Right. And the what's happening before my talk is there is a band up on stage that is absolutely killing the Jimi Hendrix All Along the Watchtower version of the song. They are killing it, right? And they get done and there's all this applause. And then somebody comes up and goes, and here's Chris. It was like so anticlimactic. I was like, you know, they're like, Chris? It was after something like that. But it was a really, really cool event. You know, that we're going to probably have more of those big open, you know, air, you know, out in the field kind of things as time goes on, I'm afraid. Anyway, you know, my name is Chris. I am an alcoholic. I understand what alcoholism is today. And I'm really, really, really grateful I understand what alcoholism is today. Because when I was dying from it, I didn't really know what was going on. I really didn't understand the problem. I didn't understand, and I certainly didn't understand the enormity of the problem. I thought I just needed to get a handle on this drinking thing. You know, if you were to ask me what my problem was. Now, and one of the things I want to start with a reading, because I think this is a very, very powerful reading. It's one of my favorite readings in any of the AA literature. And it's kind of hidden from us. It's on page 174 of the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. It's almost at the end of Tradition 9. And why it's there, I have no idea. But when I first read this, it hit me. It was like a slap across the face. I could not believe what it was saying. It says here, unless each AA member follows to the best of their ability our suggested 12 steps to recovery, they almost certainly signed their own death warrant. You know, you think they meant death warrant? You know, that's pretty strong language. This is Bill Wilson's writings. You know, he wrote these traditions, and he's basically telling me that if I don't practice these 12 steps to the best of my ability, I'm not going to survive active alcoholism. I'm not going to. It's signing my own death warrant. I'm not going to be able to move forward into this thing called recovery. And then it says their drunkenness and disillusion are not penalties inflicted by people in authority. They result from their personal disobedience to spiritual principles. So my relapse is not going to be dependent on outside things. I go to a lot of beginners meetings, right? And I can't tell you how many hands go up every single week. Oh, I'm coming back. It was terrible. And they've all got, you know, reasons. You know, I stopped going to meetings. You know, I went out with my friends. I went to see the fish, you know, play music, you know, whatever the, you know, reason they come up. Those are wrong reasons. Just like they have the wrong problem. They're wrong reasons because we relapse because of our spiritual disobedience, our personal disobedience to spiritual principles. And really what I want to do is I'm going to tell my story, but I want to talk about emotional recovery. I want to talk about spiritual recovery and how it's impacted me, how I discovered I needed it. And the process that I went through to get whatever level I have at this point in time, because it has a lot to do with my alcoholism. Alcoholism is an illness of minimization, and it's an illness of isolation. So I'm going to start with isolation, because that really was one of the things that I suffered from. I was, you know, engaged in at a very, very early age. I had what you would probably diagnose me today with, was with childhood anxiety disorder. There were some things that really made me uncomfortable. A lot of things. School made me uncomfortable. You know, joining the Boy Scouts made me uncomfortable. Anything with big crowds of people, anything with people in authority, anything with like rules that I didn't like, just kind of made me uncomfortable. And it was with that uncomfortability that I started on a path of, you know, just trying not to be involved. Just, and really it was isolation. It was isolation because I didn't feel in communion with you. I didn't feel in community with you. I felt like I was on the outside. And that was from a very young age. That was from like kindergarten on, you know. All of a sudden I discover alcohol. Can you imagine? I'm 13 years old. I find a couple of guys who are going to, you know, engage in this getting drunk thing with me. And we go about the business of getting drunk. And I pull, you know, I get them over to my house. We cut school. I pour three big water glasses of Canadian club whiskey or something. It was like some god awful thing, and warm, we drank it, you know. And it was very, very interesting what happened to the two guys that I was with. Those two individuals had half of their glass and they pushed it back. They'd had enough, you know. I don't know about you, but whenever I drank with people like that later on, it was very inconvenient. It was very annoying. You know, listen, we're just getting the party started, dude. You know, let's like get an eight ball and like go to the city, you know, it's only 11 at night, you know, let's go, you know, because, and they'd be like, well, I've got work tomorrow, or the little missus is expecting me home by 11. What? You know, so these two guys had half of their glass and they shoved it back and they'd had enough. You know, it was just, I found ways never to drink with them again. But what happened to me was somewhere almost at the bottom of my first glass, a miracle happened. Everything that was wrong was made right. All of the self-centered fear, all of the angst, all, you know, all of the feelings of being apart from and separate from melted away. And I was in union with you. This was the cool, you're my two new best friends. This is the coolest thing I've ever done in my life. You know, this is great. You know, this is cool. This is great. And my whole perspective on the world changed. And at that moment, I discovered peace. I discovered ease. I discovered comfort that was missing from my day-to-day life. I was always uncomfortable with myself and my environment, right? All of a sudden, this stuff shows me there's another way. Now, I finish that glass, I drink the rest of the bottle, you know, I go into a blackout, I come to in a field, you know, 7 hours later, you know, and with a lot of unanswered questions, and now I am sick. I am Canadian whiskey sick. And for 2 days, I've got to be like horizontal. I was as sick as you can be. And I'm thinking this whole time I'm sick, I'm thinking, I'm going to work with this alcohol stuff. You know, I'm going to, you know, we're going to find a way, you know, to get that feeling again. And I went about that quest from that day forward of how to get that feeling of ease and comfort back. You know what I mean? I needed it. It was like a vacation from the enormous, you know, stress of living inside my head. I needed that that vacation, and I went about the business of figuring out how to do that. Now, I stayed away from Canadian whiskey, but there were a couple of companies that were out there that catered to the 13-year-old market. You know, one of them was a company called Boone's Farm. I don't know if anybody remembers the wonderful catalog of products that Boone's Farm had. But they were wonderful for a 13-year-old kid, the Strawberry Hill and apple wine, all that crap, you know. And, I found stuff like blackberry brandy and Southern Comfort and all this other, you know, wine and Budweiser beer. And I started to get into all this stuff. And my managing my drinking had started. You know what I mean? Like, here's the thing. I look back, even my earliest day, what sets me apart from a normal person and puts me into the category of alcoholic are two things. One of them is the allergy to alcohol. That's the phenomenon of craving that they talk about in the doctor's opinion. How that presents in me is consider that the alcohol supply is adequate. What happens is the first drink always does one thing. It asks for the second drink. The second drink insists on the third. The third demands the fourth. And the more alcohol in my body, the more that allergy is triggered and the more I crave alcohol. So what'll happen when that's the case is if you're anything like me, you're going to get tongue chewing, knee walking, not able to operate your own pants zipper drunk. You know what I mean? And that's what would happen to me if there was enough booze. And this was like from an early age, you know, so I started to get in trouble and I started to disappoint people. And my friends would always get pissed because they'd end up having to carry me home from somewhere or something. Because once I got the motor started, I was in, you know, but I'm trying to manage this, you know, like on the John Wayne movies, they talk about the person that can handle their liquor, you know, you gotta be able to handle your liquor. So I'm like desperately trying to handle my liquor, and I'm continuously being overserved. You know, I'm continuously, you know, ending up drunker than I wanted to be. And yet I continue to manage it. I managed it by changing booze. One time I went to schnapps. How much schnapps can you drink? You know what I mean? I'm going to drink schnapps. I'll tell you, you can drink a lot of schnapps and it gets messy. You know what I mean? It's just an awful drink. So I'm mad. I'm trying to, and now I discover non-conference approved substances, if you can imagine. Now, the reason I share about these is because there was a purpose for them. The purpose was to help me manage my alcoholism. It always was to help me manage my alcoholism. So I discovered things like, you know, don't smoke two joints after drinking 37 beers, you know. So I had a rule, you know, that when something bad would go wrong, I'd have a rule, you know. But I discovered the downers, you know, Second All and Quaaludes, all this stuff. And toward the end of my drinking, I was on Xanax, because what would happen is I'd be like this in the morning, you know, and you can't go to work. I'm an electrician. I'm blowing people up, you know, because I'm shaking and I'm flipping the wrong switch. And so I'm chilling, you know, with these Xanax. And the problem with that is you're noodled. You know what I mean? You're noodled. If you're taking these Xanax the minute you wake up and you start drinking the minute you get home and you mix them up and you forget you took them and you take more, it's a mess. You don't know a sober breath, you know, for years sometimes. And it's a mess. And then I would use the stimulants, because I found that this was the velocity of my drinking. You know, I became a hard liquor drinker, and the velocity of my drinking was as such. I would start drinking, and, you know, I'm a pounder, you know, I'm the guy with the big, huge, you know, 38 ounce glass, you know, with, you know, filling it with bourbon or vodka. And what would happen is by an hour, I would be drunk. I would literally be drunk an hour after starting to drink. I would be in a blackout by 2 hours, and I'd be unconscious by 3. This cuts down on the social calendar activities, you know, like, hey, would you like to go out to the movies with me tonight? You know, and I'm passed out on the floor before, you know, halfway through the movie. It's just, it cuts down on the dating options. It cuts down on hanging with the boys. It cuts down on anything except drinking in your bedroom, you know, where you can fall down on the bed. So I discovered that there are things that are stimulants. And what they can do is they can prolong your ability to drink. And you can almost drink around the clock without getting so stupid that you just pass out, you know. And then I discovered opiates. And what the opiates did was they kept me from having the phenomenon of craving, and they kept me from having the obsession of the mind. So I could stay away from alcohol for periods of time when I was on these. So all these things, I'm pulling them all in, and I'm trying to, folks, what I'm really trying to manage is my emotional condition, because that really is what my alcoholism is. That's really how my alcoholism presents, because my alcoholism presents between the drinks. I never took the first drink drunk. You understand what I'm saying? So there's something going on. There's something going on between the drinks. And it's this toxic self-centeredness. And it's this restlessness and this just disease. And I'm always resentful, and I'm always really cautious about what I get involved with, because it's going to be, you know, it's going to go south, and I, you know, I don't want to do that, you know, don't come over my house, you know, want me to help you, you know, with something. Yeah, so I'm always avoiding a lot of stuff, And really, this is my head. My head is, I can't believe what I did yesterday. Oh my God. Oh, I don't know if I'm going to be able to live with what I did yesterday. Tomorrow's going to be a disaster. I don't want to face tomorrow. Tomorrow's going to be awful. There's going to be all this conflict and it's going to be terrible. And oh, I can't believe, you know, what I did yesterday. It was so terrible. You know, I'm so embarrassed. I'm so ashamed that tomorrow's going to be worse. That's my head. And my head is trying to kill me. Now, how do you have any kind of emotional, you know, condition? How do you have a healthy emotional condition when you're living with that kind of conflict, you know, within your own thought system, you know, your stream of consciousness? And so what I was doing is that was getting worse and worse as my alcoholism was progressing. That thought system was getting more and more toxic. I needed to pour more and more alcohol on it. I was finally just drinking for the oblivion that alcohol would give me, that space between emotional thought. You know what I mean? And I would get that somewhere between drink 7 and drink 9 and then pass out. And the next day I'd start the whole ball of wax over again. And it was absolutely, absolutely an awful experience. Now, I want to read another thing. And this is another one of my very, very favorite writings. This is from the foreword to the 12 and 12. It says, AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink, which is important if you're an alcoholic, and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. I want to be happily and usefully whole. I felt happily and usefully whole between drink 7 and drink 9, but this stuff was turning on me. You know what I mean? Or I'd get the combination wrong with the non-conference stuff. But that's what I was seeking all along. I was seeking the ease and the comfort within my own mind. And I'm coming into Alcoholics Anonymous thinking I've just got a drink problem that I got to get under control. I don't even know what I'm up against in the beginning. What happens is you get exposed to this stuff after you've been in AA a while. You get a sponsor. The sponsor starts pushing you through the steps, and then it starts to dawn on you what you're up against here. There's two things that are absolutely true with every newcomer that walks through the door, be they alcoholic. One of the truths is they're in 10 times more trouble than they think they are. You know, it is an illness of minimization. We minimize, you know, I should cut down on, you know, I should cut it back a little. Cut it back a little. Your life is a dumpster fire and you want to cut it back a little. You know, it's an illness of minimization. And the other thing that's true that's really good, though, that's the bad news, that you're in 10 times more trouble than you think you are. The good news is Alcoholics Anonymous has 10 times more to offer you than what you're giving it credit for in the beginning. You're looking around and, you know, everybody's kind of happy and you're circling up at the end of the meeting and you're holding hands and saying the Lord's Prayer. And this is all good. And this is all fine. I'm not really sure this is for me. Alcoholics Anonymous is a pathway into the peace that we need to be able to recover. Okay, how did all this come about with me? Well, you know, what's my story with all of this? All right, I'm coming to AA. I'm going to a lot of AA meetings. You know, I was out of plans. Alcohol had got my attention so much. I knew if I continued to keep drinking it, I would be dead in 6 months, and probably I would commit a homicide on somebody that I didn't want to commit a homicide on, because I was a Jekyll and Hyde drinker, and I was extremely violent in some of these blackouts, because somebody would say something, you know how they are. You know, they're going to say something. What did you say? What did you mean by that? You know, and I would just fly into a rage that had nothing to do with reality. And I knew I was going to come to in jail with the police officer looking at me and going, nice job. You just killed your family. That's what I was afraid of. You know, we're not really afraid of dying ourselves. You know, a lot of times we take our own lives, you know, but we are afraid of suffering. We're afraid to continue to feel bad. We're afraid to continue to suffer emotionally the way we're suffering. So I show up in Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm like, I've got the tension of a garage door spring. You know what I mean? Like 500 pounds of tension that, like, if the bolt comes off, it's going to snap and bust through your car. You know what I mean? Like that's me. And I'm just trying to hold it together. And I show up in Alcoholics Anonymous and I make a real commitment to start going to meetings, and I'm going to meetings every night. I get a sponsor on day two and he goes, I'm just going to tell you one thing, Chris. And that's, I want you to go to a meeting every night until I tell you to stop. And okay. Okay. You know, so I'm going to these meetings. I'm hating it. Not only am I hating the meetings, there's very few of you I care much for. You know what I mean? Like I am an example of projecting outward, you know, all of my resentments and my fears and everything, and making that your problem. You know, the step work takes all of that and it points it back the way it needs to be pointed to me. And I need to find a way to deal with all this stuff because it's coming from me. You know what I mean? They're not doing it. They're not out there to get me. They're not disrespecting me. They're not trying to make me feel small. That's my alcoholism. That's my perception. I've got a damaged perception. So I'm sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous and I am not liking it. It's about 6 months into this. And I make my first friend in AA, you know, this first guy who had the courage to like chat me up and, you know, say, hey, let's go to a meeting together sometime, you know, and all that. And I've got this friend that I made in AA. But I got to tell you, I am no vision for you in my first year. I am the person that you got to be really careful about. You know, the wonderful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is we're not afraid of you. No matter how far down the scale you've gone, you are welcome with us. Oh, you rob banks? Ah, come on in. There's a whole row back here of people that rob banks. You know, I mean, we're not afraid of you. And the place was, it made a safe place for me to come out of my isolation and to start, you know, integrating back in to society and into, you know, people, like being with people, which was something I avoided like the plague, you know, in the years prior. So I got this new friend, you know, Radio Shack Mike, right? And me and Radio Shack Mike are going to meetings. The poor guy, we would drive the meetings together. And the whole, as soon as we got out of the meeting, the whole way home, all I did was criticize the people in the meeting. Oh, did you hear so-and-so? You know, what a hypocrite. What a jackass. I can't believe. You know, I mean, I was toxic. And I remember this guy's face. He was just like, you know, he's just smiling. You know, he was like, thank God I am not as sick as this dude. You know, let's go to a meeting tomorrow. You know what I mean? And every day I might be getting like that much better. Maybe because I'm going to like a million meetings. I'm making coffee over here. I'm a secretary over there. I'm a treasurer over there because I was told that you told me to say yes. You know, if I had the time and I had the ability, you know, I was to say yes. So I was doing all these things, but I've got to tell you, emotionally, I was getting maybe that much better. Spiritually, I was maybe getting that much better. I still was really uncomfortable with this whole thing. I still had the mind that was like, I can't believe what I did yesterday. I can't believe, I can't, oh, I, what did I say? I can't believe I said that. Oh, geez, tomorrow, I got to go to that meeting tomorrow. Tomorrow there's going to be somebody, that guy's going to be there that I'm like, I got to make coffee. I can't believe what I did yesterday. It was just terrible. You know what I mean? Like, that's the way I am sitting in these AA meetings. How long do you think I'm going to last, you know, with this kind of emotional thought structure? So what happened was this guy, Radio Shack Mike, started getting involved in spiritual stuff. He was starting to go to the New Age bookstores and he was starting to read a lot of this stuff. And almost every time we met, you know, he'd have like this new thing. He was very pious. And you know, like one day he'd go, Chris, man, you know, I put a pyramid over my bed and it's righteous. You should get a pyramid and put it over your bed, you know? And one time he goes, Chris, I got these crystals. You know, you need the really serious crystals, you know, but I got these crystals, you know, I'll take you to get the crystals. And you know, another time it's like affirmations, Chris, I'm doing affirmations in the mirror every morning and I feel wonderful. I remember trying to do affirmations. I'm like, you're sitting in front of the mirror, Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Chris, I'm a scumbag. You know, I'd like throw the book. It's just that trying to treat alcoholism with affirmations is like trying to stop a semi with a cobweb. You know what I mean? That is not the tool to be using. So I'm struggling. One day he comes up to me and he goes, Chris, here, I want you to listen to this. And I go, well, what is it? He gives me these 8-90 minute cassette tapes, right? He goes, it's a big book workshop. Big book. You mean the book they gave me in treatment, you know, like a year ago? And he goes, yeah, that book. Because there were no big book meetings in the area I was going to AA in 1989 and 90. So the book wasn't used very much. So, you know, sponsors weren't used. It was 12 in 12 land, you know, in 1990 in New Jersey. So I go a big book workshop. I go, who's doing it? And he goes, a couple of guys from Arkansas. These two guys from Arkansas. I'm like, Arkansas. I look at, you know, I do the math on the 8-90 minute tapes. That's 12 hours of guys from Arkansas reading a book that was published in 1939. How about killing me instead? You know what I mean? But he makes me promise to listen to these. So I'm like, all right, okay, I'll listen. And you know, I've got a half an hour ride to work and I've got a cassette player in my car and I start to listen to these tapes. And I'm like, they perk me up. Now, don't get me wrong. My first impression of these tapes was a very, very negative one. Okay, I remember, you know, what they talked about was the program of recovery that's in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. What I heard was, Chris, you're like your fellowshipping. You're the pope of the fellowship. You got fellowship written all over you. But if you're not working a program out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't have a program. And if you don't have a program, when you relapse, please don't tell everybody that AA doesn't work because you never worked a program. Now, that message was not something I was grateful to hear. It was something I was very pissed off at because I'm going to 12 meetings a week. I'm the coffee maker over here. I'm the treasurer over there. You know, people are patting me on the head. I see you everywhere, Chris. You're staying sober. You're doing good, you know? But maybe that's how they do it in Arkansas, you know, with all these inventories and stuff. In New Jersey, we go to closed-minded discussion meetings and we share, you know, these guys from Arkansas. And And I shoved him aside, you know, and I was grumbled about him, you know, when he asked me, have you listened to them? Yeah, listen to them. Now, here's the thing. These two guys spoke with experience and they spoke with authority. And it sunk into me, right? I didn't care much for the message, but it sunk in. And there's a great line in the chapter, Working with Others. It says, if you've disturbed someone about their alcoholism, this is all to the good. And what those tapes did was they disturbed me about my alcoholism. They showed me another side to this AA thing. I already knew about sobriety. I already knew alcohol was off the table, but I was out of my mind. And what they talked about as far as the step process, they explained what the step was, how do you do the step, and what you can expect to get from the step. You know, so what motivated me into this second surrender, you know, this second sober bottom, which, you know, a lot of us have experienced and know exactly what I'm talking about, was I got lifed. Three things happened in the same week. I lost my job. I started to get mail from another state with terminology like fleeing to avoid prosecution. You know, the computers were coming online, you know, in like 1990, 91. And the states where you conveniently left before, you know, really handling any of the law enforcement dealage, you know, were starting to find you. And they were threatening to take my license away. So my license is going to go. I lose my job. And the person I met on the druggy buggy, you know, that I was dating, you know, dumped me. So like three things all in like 1 week, you know what I mean? It was really, really a bad deal. And you want to talk about emotional, no one suffers like the alcoholic. We corner the market on suffering and we do it sober. You know what I mean? So I was distraught and I made a pilgrimage right over to my sponsor's house. And I remember knocking on the door and he opens up the door. He's not used to me just showing up, you know, Chris, what's going on? And I couldn't even talk. I could not vocal. I was so emotionally shattered that I could not vocalize. So he brings me in, he gets me a cup of coffee. I sit there for a while and he goes, go home and pray. You know, I go home and pray. And the thought comes to my mind. Now you got to understand, we get to a turning point. We get to a jumping off point sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of us jump out when we get to this jumping off point. Some of us take our own lives. Some of us end up in the hatch. You know what I mean? But some of us jump in. When we're at the jumping off point, we jump in. And what I did was I pulled these tapes back out. I blew the dust off of my big book and I took these steps as a serious piece of business, not out of any sense of virtue. I just didn't want to feel bad anymore. You know what I mean? I didn't want to feel bad anymore. And I start going through these 12 steps. And I did a crappy job of them, right? And listen, folks, I don't believe people get drunk because they do a crappy job of the 12 steps. I believe they get drunk because they don't do the 12 steps. You know, they disobey the spiritual principles inherent in the 12 steps, because this is our recovery process. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't have other recovery programs. They don't have other options. We've got a 12-step recovery process. We don't, you know, there's nothing else. You know what I mean? You can take them as suggestions. You can ignore them. You can languish in the back row year after year, slowly dying from untreated alcoholism if you so wish, because our doors are so wide open. We want you with us no matter what state you're in, but we only got one thing. And that's the 12 steps. So I start going through these 12 steps. I'm listening to the tapes. I got my big book open. I got a pad and a pencil. And when they would say to do something, you know, I would do it. And I've looked back at some of the inventory. I've looked back at some of the stuff that I put together in 1990. And I got to tell you, I wouldn't accept that from a sponsee today, you know, but I'm giving them, you know, direction now. Back then, sponsors weren't telling people how to go through the steps. I remember sitting in a four-step meeting. I was going to do my four-step, so I'm going to a bunch of four-step meetings. And I remember this kid, he didn't know any better, raised his hand. He goes, excuse me, I have a question. How do you do a four-step? And the next hand that goes up is one of those crusty old-timers, you know, one of those guys with the big cigars, you know, kid, you do a four-step with a pencil. You know, that was the instruction he gave this guy. You do a four step with a pencil, and underneath every skirt's a slip. You know, I mean, he was like the king of one-liners, this guy. And everybody's like, looked up, whoa, looking up to this guy. All he had was a bunch of one-liners. So anyway, I'm digressing. So I start to go through the steps with some instructions from, you know, Joe and Charlie. They were some of the first two guys that got together and went around the country and like brought back into consciousness, into the consciousness of the fellowship, that the recovery program is also of significant importance, especially if you happen to be alcoholic, especially if you happen to be in real trouble. Now, so I do my four step. You know, I do my fifth step. I put, you know, six and seven, I was a little confused about, you know, so I went about the business. This is my first time through. I went about the business of working on my character defects. You ever try to work on your character defects? What an exercise in futility that is. Have you ever seen that game Whack-A-Mole? You know, where you got the mallet and like a mole pop up, and you know, by the time you've whacked that mole, another mole pops up. That's me working on my character defects. I'm whacking the mole. You know what I mean? It was too much for me. And in the big book, it says that we are not going to get rid of selfishness just by wanting it. We're not going to be able to, self is not going to kill self. You know, our problem resides in our mind. The solution is not going to come from us intellectually. You know, that is absolutely the wrong discipline. I just wanted to read all the books. Give me the new Hazelton book on, you know, the joy of resentment, or, you know, I'll read the joy of resentment, and, I'll figure this resentment thing out. That's how I tried to attack things. Well, this inventory flipped all that on its head. And the exercises that it gave me were constructive exercises and really, really digging in and looking at these resentments. What were they? You know, what were they? Well, how did they manifest? What, you know, how do you get out of them? How do you stop having them? Fear is like an evil and corroding thread. It's killing me. It's gonna take me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. This anxiety that I have is going to take me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's an evil and corroding thread that is going to kill me. How am I going to start to outgrow these fears? And the shame and the guilt and the remorse of yesterday, especially where it concerned my intimate relationships, was horrific. I suffered incredibly because I did not want to be the jackass that I was. I did not want to hurt the people that I actually cared about. I didn't want to be that guy, but I was. We're not bad people. We just do bad things. We're not stupid people, but boy, do we do stupid things. We're being driven by this alcoholism and this spiritual malady and this bondage of self and seeing everything in a selfish and self-centered perspective. So I start to discover some of this stuff. Today, I understand six and seven much better. You know, we become willing to have God remove these defects of character, and we humbly ask God to remove these defects of character. The end. You know what I mean? We then take our energy from that point forward, and we put it into making amends for where these character defects have caused harm. That is the next thing we do. We do not work on our character defect. So, you know, so I get to the amends thing after the futile attempts at not being selfish. And I start to put a list together, and actually go out and make amends. Actually, I think if I could change one word in the 12 steps, it would be to put actually in front of the ninth step, because I cannot tell you how many people I've bumped into in the course of the fellowship that are friends of mine or that I sponsored who think that, you know, that it might not, you know, these amends might not be necessary. You know, and I agree with them in theory. You know, you ever meet the people that agree with them in theory? Now, there was this wonderful dude. I'm going to digress all over the place, but there's this wonderful dude that was in the fellowship in the 90s with me. And he was a lawyer, and he ran the legal department for the bank in New York or something. He was like, you know, had tons of money and everything, but he was alcoholic. He shows up and he was wonderful. He would do things like it would be a step meeting and we'd be on step 9 and he'd raise his hand to share. And he would do this, go, I haven't done this step formally, but I'm going to take this meeting hostage for 5 minutes, giving you my opinion on what I think it's all about. You know, I mean, the step meetings were filled with stuff like that. It's Alcoholics Anonymous has gotten a lot better over the years. But anyway, I digress. Anyway, I went out and I started making direct amends to these people. And I've got to tell you, the comfort level, with Chris being Chris, started to really get good. The anxiety started to drop off of me. I started to outgrow fear, resentment. I didn't wake up in the morning and think to, you know, pull my head off the pillow and go, those bastards, you know, I would do that. You know, the first thing I think of, I'm gonna get them. You know, none of that stuff was happening. I was starting to have an experience, a spiritual experience. And I was starting to get comfortable with this thing called life. Now, you don't know any of this stuff going in, right? You have to take so much on faith. You have to take Alcoholics Anonymous on faith in many, many different periods of time, because you don't know what the fourth step is going to do for you until you do the fourth step. You don't know the benefit of making amends until you've made amends. It's experiential. It's not an intellectual program. It's not a theory. It's a way of life, this Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm involved in this stuff and I'm starting to get better. You know, I'm starting to get better. And people are recognizing it before I am. I'm comfortable now. Don't I have the anxiety that I used to have going to the meetings, but I want to go to the meetings because my friends are there. You know, there's a whole shift in perspective that's happening to me. Like I'm waking up, you know, it's a spiritual awakening. I'm waking up And I'm starting to really have a lot of faith in this process, in the recovery process. I'm starting to have a lot of faith in the service requests and the reaction I have from the service commitments. And I'm starting to understand that maybe I don't need to understand all this stuff. Maybe I need to develop a discipline, and the discipline is just to do the things that I'm asked to do, to take the next indicated step, to work with the next indicated person. And I'm supposed to do that, because that's part of the spiritual process. It's part of the Alcoholics Anonymous way of life. Now, you know, what have I experienced? What have I experienced with all this stuff? I talked to you on this Zoom technology tonight with an awakened spirit. Okay. My spirit has been awakened because of the action that I've taken in the 12 steps. Now, the one thing I can say is I see things as they really are now. okay, or at least close to as they really are. It's, you know, I'm not, you know, my thought systems and my attitudes and my outlooks are not tangled up in, you know, untreated alcoholism. They're not tangled up in my resentments and my fears and my shame and all that. And you know, I'm awake today. It does not make me a perfect person. You know, the steps are not designed to bring us to a level of perfection as human beings. What they're designed to do is they're designed to move the self-imposed obstacles away enough for there to be a clear line to the sunlight of the Spirit. So we've got all this crap in the way of our experience with God. It's all over the place. We can't experience God. We're too tangled up in self. And little by slowly, what happens going through these steps, we move obstacles out of the way until there's a clear line to the sunlight of the Spirit. And God can do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. God is now in charge of so much in my life. I had to admit in step one, I can't manage my life. Well, if I can't manage my life, you know, what do? You fire the manager and you seek through prayer and meditation to try to find God's will. And you pray to God for God's will and the power to carry that out, and you start to live life along spiritual lines. And when you do that, things clear up. And here's the brass ring. I'd have done all that just to not kill my family, you know, or drink myself to death. I've done all of that. For the recovery process from Alcoholics Anonymous brings about a series of, I think at last count, there's like 200 really significant promises in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. How about the most satisfactory years are ahead of you? Think about that as a promise. How about follow these dictates and you will live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances? How's that for a promise? You know, when you place it in God's hands, you're going to get so much more than you could have ever planned yourself. So no matter what you wanted, you're going to get more than, you're going to get better than that when you start to live life along spiritual lines. I've experienced all of these. You will create the fellowship you crave. You will have a host of friends. And you know, I always wanted a host of friends. My last friends when I was drinking didn't really even have names. They were like Weezer and Green Man. There was a guy named Rat, you know, who made sure that you spelled that with two T's. You know, those were like the guys that I was partying with at the end. Today, I've got friends all over the country, all over the world. You know, I have been overpaid with this Alcoholics Anonymous thing. And, you know, I almost missed it. I almost missed it. If somebody didn't hand me those Joe and Charlie tapes, I might have missed it. And I might have thought, you know, this just isn't working for me. This staying sober one miserable day at a time is not working. And I would have said, I'm out of here. By seconds and inches, folks, you know, we're here. But somebody handed me 8 90-minute cassette tapes with a solution. And I'm incredibly grateful for that. And, you know, I think I'm close enough to the hour, David, to hand it back. What do you think?
Sure. Thank you. I'm going to unmute everybody and allow you to say thanks to Chris.
Thanks, Chris. That was awesome.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was awesome.
Chris. Good job, Chris.
I want to hang with you, Chris.
That was great, Chris.
It was wonderful.
Thank you, Chris.
Oh.
All right, so what's next? Do we have questions?
Oops. Sorry, I muted you, Chris. I muted you by accident. I was just about to mute everybody and take the meeting back. let's give Chris a break for a couple of minutes. I'm just going to call for announcements, Path of Seven Tradition Basket, and remind everybody, if you've got questions for Chris, please send them to the user questions, and we're going to cobble those together, and then just in a few minutes, we'll reconvene and start interviewing you. It's going to be fun. Everyone's going to enjoy it. So I posted the seventh tradition link again. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. I will take a couple of AA-related announcements by show of hands. Anybody have such a thing? All right, I don't have one. Although the Virginia Assembly is coming up next weekend, all AAs are welcome to that. Let's see, Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you to not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available after we close this meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, you can send an email to info@simpleactions.net. Chris, that was amazing, brother. Thank you so much. Somebody texted me, this is a breath of fresh air. So yeah, we're at, great. Questions are coming in. Please keep them coming. Thank you guys for submitting. Chris, somebody wants to know, what is your sobriety date and do you still live where you got sober, or where'd you get sober and where do you live now?
My sobriety date is on or around December 28th, 1989. Was kind of a bleak and hazy series of days. I had come out of a 5-day blackout. So that's the day I'm comfortable with. You know, it might have been the day after or the day before. But it was 1980, end of 1989. I live about two towns away from where I was born and raised, but I've moved around a lot. I've lived in Florida. I've lived in North Carolina. I've lived in Colorado. I've lived in Connecticut. And, you know, I'm like a bad penny. I always roll my way back to New Jersey for one reason or another.
All right. At the top of your talk, you mentioned toxic self-centeredness and the discomfort between drinks. Is that a fair characterization of alcoholism?
All right. Men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the truth from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks they see other people taking with impunity. So that's a little bit about the unmanageability. That's a little bit about the uncomfortability, but I'm also prey to misery, depression, anxiety, self-centered fear, shame, guilt, remorse. The hideous four horsemen are part of my untreated alcoholism: terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair, you know, a pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. All of those descriptions that come from the book Alcoholics Anonymous are pieces of my untreated alcoholism. They're pieces of my spiritual malady. They're pieces of the emotional state of an unrecovered alcoholic.
All right. Did you ever have an amends go or seem to go poorly?
Yes, I had an ex-boss. I spent the last 2 years of my active drinking working for this poor guy. I made him look bad 13 ways from Sunday. And, I went off to treatment, and when I got out of treatment, he wasn't hiring at that time, right? So I'm sober and it's time for amends. And I got, I go back, go over to his office because he had a local office. He was an electrical contractor. And I knocked on the door and, he opened the door. He goes, "You, what do you want? What are you doing here? Yeah, I'm busy. I don't even know why you're here. Get out of here." So he throws me out of the office, right? So a couple of months later, I'm persistent. So I want to check this one off the list. "You again? What are you doing? Listen, I told you before, I don't want to hear it. Whatever you got, I don't want it. Get out of here." Right. So I leave. Now it's a couple of months later and I'm going to get my hair cut, and it's a little barbershop with like six chairs, where you're waiting two barbers, and who's in there? My ex-boss. So I sidle over to him and I sit down, and he can't get away now. And it's just me and him. And I do my deal. I make my demonstration. I express to him how I was wrong. And, I asked him a bunch of questions, like, "Is there anything that I need to do to make this right? You want to talk to me about how I embarrass you, whatever." And after that, about 6 months after that, I'm a facility manager and he's my electrical contractor, So have I ever had an amends that went so toxically bad that there wasn't some kind of positive outcome? I can't say that I have.
All right. The way you describe it, it sounds like you and Joe and Charlie sponsored you through the steps that first time. Could you discuss being sponsored and sponsoring others?
Yes. All right. I'm talking 1990. A good sponsor was somebody who was in charge of your consistent meeting attendance. A really good sponsor was somebody that was in charge of your meeting attendance and would push you towards service commitments, like raise your hand, volunteer, do this, do that. It was unheard of in my area for a sponsor to say, "Come on over to my house and we'll open the big book and we'll start going through the steps." So my first experience with the 12 steps was with Joe and Charlie. That doesn't mean my sponsor wasn't a great sponsor. It doesn't mean that my sponsor didn't save my life by really enabling me to and encouraging me to continue on with the fellowship. And he was always somebody I could talk to. But that's the way I was sponsored early on. Personally, I've never had a big book esque sponsor. I have had sponsors that have incredible lives. They understand how to be in a successful marriage. They understand how to be successful in business. They know how to be a good neighbor. They have a service ethic, like a really, really serious service ethic. Now, I did get an opportunity to go through the steps with Joe Hawk in 2001. He was one of my heroes. I was listening to his tapes for years. I ended up doing a retreat with him, and asked him to take me through the work. So I've been through the work with people, but it's usually not been my sponsor. I've shared my fifth steps with my sponsor, but I've put a lot of work into understanding these steps and how to do these steps. No one has had to help me with them. They're simple. How we screw them up is we overcomplicate them. There's an economy to these steps. These steps were designed for someone to take who is 3 days away from the booze and who should be on their amends at the end of the week. You know, that's how these were designed. So you know, I listened to a lot of big book workshops and that helped my vocabulary. You know, I'm very, very good at describing, you know, these steps and these processes because I've listened to a lot of these workshops. But my sponsors have been people that have shown me how to live life. You know, the step work, you know, I got in a lot of different places. That's I know that's unusual. Many people have had sponsors that have taken them through the steps, and God bless you. That was not an option for me.
Well, how about the fellows that come to you for help? Do you take them through the book, or do you take them through the same way that you went through? Or,
you know, I don't have a cookie cutter approach. I used to bring people over to my house and we would start on the title page and we would go through every single sentence. And it would take 3, 4, 5 months, you know, for them to do all the step work. And you know, I've evolved as a sponsor. You'll intuitively know how to handle sponsees that would usually baffle you is one of the promises, I think, in the ninth step. And what I'm interested in now is making sure they have a complete concession to the first step. You know, I'll spend some time on that. They need to know what they're up against. If they can truly comprehend what they're up against, the rest of the step work is going to be easy. And again, you know, I'm not looking for perfection in this step work. I'm not. It's a way of life. You know, we like to think that this is an exercise that, you know, this is my finals. You know, I'm going to go through my finals and then, you know, I'm out of college. That's not what this is. This is that you constantly reapply these steps and you constantly pull these steps out where they're appropriate and use them. So, and you also have to leave room for God. If you are too didactic, if you're too into the mechanics of these steps, you can lose sight of the spirit. And God is there, man. When you're taking somebody through the steps, God is there. It's going to be okay, you know. But step one, really, I have to be convinced that they're convinced of step one, or else we're both wasting our time.
Yeah, I came into the same AA that you described, and Bob D talks about that too. And he also credits Joe and Charlie for kind of bringing that consciousness back. And he's, you know, he points out that the pendulum is swung in the way of, he refers to them as big book technicians, where we're just so lost in the letter of the law, we've maybe missed the spirit sometimes.
You can starve to death reading the cookbook. I understand all that. You know, Joe and Charlie are 12-step recovery 101. I move very, very quickly into Joe Hawk and Mark Houston, which is graduate level, you know, step work. And those guys became my guys. You know, I listened to their workshops for 20 years and I ended up becoming really, really good friends with both of them, you know, and did a ton of stuff with them, which is just, you know, amazing. They're both at the big meeting now. But you know, there's a wealth of material out there. Bob D does a wonderful, I think his best work is he was doing a workshop with Scott Lee in Narragansett, Rhode Island one time, and Scott Lee couldn't make it. So Bob did the whole weekend, you know, Friday nights, all day, Saturday, Sunday into the afternoon. And he went through all the steps. And that's a wonderful piece of work if you can get it. Bob D. Roadie Recovery Weekend. But there's a ton of people. There's Bob Bazance. There's Sandy Beach. You know, there's the Ramers. There's Peter Marinelli. I mean, I could name 50 people that have things that are really valuable and really worth our time listening to and even studying. And listening to them and studying is great, but when we actually put that stuff into action, you know, that's when our life changes.
When could you talk a little bit about what your step 10 and 11 looks like on a daily basis? We're having lots of questions about this.
You know, I try to do what the book says. So if it says we watch for selfishness, dishonesty, you know, we ask God immediately, you know, if we need to talk to someone, there are actual instructions in step 10. And there's upon awakening, as we move through the day, when we retire at night, there's instructions in there. And I believe it's a good discipline. Do any of us do this perfectly? You know, do all of us do a perfect evening review or a perfect upon awakening? Or are we continually watching for selfishness? No. And when the perfect person shows up, we'll kill them. You know what I mean? So no one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. So what I will tell you is when, and that's more often this year than it was last, when I apply the disciplines of step 10 and 11, I get really, really great results. I get really, really great results. I do more prayer and meditation this year than I did last. I did more in prayer and meditation last year than the year before. I've grown into this. It's become an organic experience. You know, it's not like castor oil treatment anymore. Like, I've got to write my evening review. You know, it's more organic. And I believe the more we get in communion with God, the more we bring God with us in everything we do, I think we're following the letter of that law. Those were exercises that were meant to get us in touch with a power greater than ourselves and help us to pray for knowledge of that power's will and the power to carry that out. And as we mature in our recovery, as we gain emotional recovery, what will happen is if we continue to do these things, you know, it's just going to get better and better. And that's been my experience. You know, a lot of times here's something for you. Okay. You know, somebody will come up to you and they'll say, you know, I got a problem with meditation. And you'll go, okay, well, how do you meditate? Well, I don't meditate. Well, you don't have a problem with meditation then. You have a problem with commitment. You know what I mean? How about committing to meditate? How about doing meditation poorly for a while? You know, same thing can be true with prayer. Same thing can be true with the evening review. Same thing can be true with as we move through the day. You know, all of these are disciplines that none of us are going to be perfect at, but we need to progress. We need to move forward. You know, we need to continue to make the effort to apply these principles in our lives.
Speaking of commitment, would you maybe share a little bit about what being a member of the home group has meant to your recovery?
You know, I've always had a home group from day one. I've always had a home group. Some of the home groups I left with a resentment, you know, I'm out of here, you know, and leaving a home group is like going, you know, the dialysis attendant was really, really rude today. Screw that dialysis, you know, like when you're leaving a home group, it's like that bad. But I've joined other home groups. And, I was in a non-solution based home group, you know, for 20 some years. It was they went to my weddings, you know, we went to funerals together, we supported each other. And I was like one of the lone big book dudes, you know, and if somebody was being sponsored by me, they were going through the steps and then they were annoying everybody in the meeting by sharing about it, you know, and that was one of my home groups. 1997, I had a meeting at my house. This is a pretty cool story. I had a meeting at my house where I was taking my sponsees through the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and we were all doing the steps. Well, one of the people that, you know, was a chronic relapser. This guy was a chronic relapser. And he's in the middle of step 9 and he's got like 3 months sober. And this was like a miracle, this guy. And a priest who knew him said, what the hell's going on with you? He goes, well, I'm going through the steps, you know, with this guy named Chris. And tell me more about that, right? So this priest shows up at, at a speaking commitment I'm doing and waits until the thank you line is over, comes up to me and says, Chris, I've heard about what you're doing at your house on Thursday nights. I want you to do that at my church. Exactly what you're doing on Thursday night, I want you to do it at my church. I want it to be part of our mission. So I'm like, uh-oh. At that period of time, they had step meetings. They had speaker meetings. They had closed-minded discussion meetings. They did not have Chris teaching out of the big book meetings. And this is basically what the guy asked me to do. So we started, if it's not the first, it's darn near the first big book presentation workshop meeting in Bernalsville, New Jersey in 1997. And that became my home group and has been my home group, except for the periods of time I've moved around the country. But when I've moved around the country, I've joined other home groups. You're not an AA, you don't get counted as an AA member unless you're in a home group, you know? You can go to meetings. Listen, you can do whatever you want in AA, but I feel it's my responsibility to be a home group member. You know, that's my experience.
Thank you. Chris, my life is a dumpster fire. Do you have any recommendations for not being a jerk at work?
All right. Every alcoholic shows up in Alcoholics Anonymous and their boss is an idiot. Okay. If only we would be put in charge, you know, things would be better. Everything would be better. They'd be better. You know, the business would be better. You know, this is an expression of self-centeredness. This is the manifestation. It says in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, we have to come to the conclusion that self had defeated us. Think about that. Self defeated us. I mean, that's what they're saying alcoholism is. Self defeating us. So we all have these selfish and self-centered tendencies. And how they manifest is they ain't doing it right. This isn't fair. I don't understand. Why did they do that? You know, and what happens with really, really strong recovery, with a run through the steps, what happened to me was I went from being a bad electrician blowing people up to a person who was in charge of pharmaceutical research and development sites. Okay. And I didn't do that because I read the Tony Robbins books. That happened because you taught me to be honest, to give them a dime for their nickel. You know what I mean? To tell, listen, this alone will change your work life. Tell them what you're going to do and then do what you tell them you're going to do. That right there will revolutionize your career path, believe it or not. You know what I mean? So we've got to set aside these old ideas that we know everything about everything. And we've got to go in with a beginner mind and just, you know, what would you have me do? You take the employment like it's a service commitment, like it's God's business. And you go in like it's God's business. And you'll get successful that way. Bosses don't want to promote people who have attitudes. Bosses want to promote people who support the business goals, you know? So that's the best I can give you on business.
Thank you. What is one fellowship statement? I'm not sure what we mean by that, but maybe something commonly heard in the fellowship. But the question reads, what is one fellowship statement you don't like and why?
It's a selfish program is the number one on my hit parade, okay? Because I used to hear that all the time. And the only people that were sharing that were people that didn't have any recovery. You know, they were going to therapy and they had issues with their family and you know, it's a selfish program and I've got to take care of myself, you know, and they had absolutely no recovery. This is anything but a selfish program. Self had defeated us. Why would this be a selfish program? This program is about becoming unselfish, but about developing a service ethic, developing compassion, and going out of our way to benefit the lives of other people. Here's a lesson. This is a beautiful lesson. I'm 8 months sober, and my sponsor comes over to my house. So I'm not used to this, right? And he knocks on the door. I must be in trouble or something. He wanted to talk to me about something. We go up in my room. And I'm a reader. I've always been a reader. I read everything that you could read. And when I got sober, I bought every Hazleton book that you could possibly buy, Humility and Beyond, like every book that you could possibly buy. And I'm a codependent, you're a codependent, hooray, every single book. And he starts, he's scratching his chin and he's looking at my bookcase and he goes, Chris, you got a lot of self-help books here. And I'm like, yeah, Phil. Yeah. I'm kind of proud that I spent all that money on self-help books. And he goes, can I ask you a question? And I go, sure, Phil. He goes, can you point me to your Help Others books? And I go, I'm unfamiliar with that category, Phil. Where would I find those in the borders? You know what I mean? Like how selfish is buying self-help books? You know what I mean? That's the toxic nature of our spiritual malady. You know, we got to work on ourselves. What Alcoholics Anonymous tells us is no, you got to work on others. You got to help others. And that doesn't make any sense until you do it and it takes you out of yourself.
Well, that was such a gold mine. You got a number two common phrase that.
Easy does it, okay? Easy never did nothing, okay? Easy doesn't do nothing. We have to get busy. There's terminology in our book, like we launched out into a vigorous course of action. Next, next we did this. That's how it moves us through the recovery process. There's two things that can trip you up in the steps. You can lose your momentum in the steps because you just start taking breaks in the steps. And if you lose the momentum in the steps, you can lose the grace. The grace is what's keeping you sober. I can't tell you how many people have drank in the process of doing all kinds of other things except the steps. You know what I mean? I'd be over there going over the four step with you today, but Tuesday, I scrape my feet Tuesday. You know what I mean? And it's been part of my, it's part of my schedule, Easy never did nothing. So should we be easy on other people? Should we like lighten up on criticism and having these crazy expectations about how the world needs to treat us? I'll buy that. But those statements did not come, they came from well-meaning people who did not understand us. You know what I mean? They didn't understand what alcoholics were up against.
Well, once again, it has been a rapid 90 minutes. We've got a couple of questions. We might not get to them all, but just in case we're at the end, I'll ask this one for sure. Would you be willing to share how you enlarge your spiritual life today?
Through work and self-sacrifice for others.
All right, we can get another one in there. Do you take your sponsees through traditions and or concepts?
Not always. A lot of times my sponsees are people who've been around a long time. They're looking for a new experience. They've got 10, 20 years sober. If they go to meetings with me, I teach them how to be a good member. I'll give you, for instance, let's say there's a meeting like this that has 38 people on, and there's enough time for 10 people to share. I'll explain to them that you should do the math And you should not be the person raising your hand every single meeting, you know, do the math, and the math would break it down that, you know, unless you got some burning desire or something, share about every fourth meeting. You know, there's things like that, like just being a good AA member, just being, you know, a respectful, compassionate AA member. There are some people that do tradition workshops that I like a lot. I like the Polly and Dave Pistol traditions and relationships workshop. I like the Mary Pearl Al-Anon, you know, traditions and relationships. David Aronofsky, the dentist down in Texas, long gone. He did wonderful, wonderful tradition studies and using the historical concepts. I understand them and I try to follow them to the absolute best of my ability. The concepts, you know, there's a great piece of writing in Concept 12. It's in the Warranties, and it basically says this: Alcoholics Anonymous has absolutely no right to punish you for doing AA wrong. There's no way for them to punitively punish us as AA members for making mistakes. Now, isn't that amazing? Some of Bill's best writings are in the concepts, but a lot of that applies, you know, at a service level. So, you know, if I've got somebody heavy duty into service, I'll give them the Don Pritz 12 concept studies. You know, Billy Noonan does some good concept workshops. There are people that teach that better than me. And if someone really needs to know that stuff to be effective service members, you know, I'll point them in those directions.
What do you think kept you abstinent until you were able to begin the steps and the solution?
The grace of God. And the grace of God lasts as long as ignorance or inattention. You know what I mean? Listen, I went into AA. I was desperate to stay separate from alcohol. I'm doing 12 meetings. I'm saying yes to everything. I'm absolutely desperate to stay away from alcohol. And I believe that that was a grace period. Some people call it a pink cloud. You're on a pink cloud. You know, a lot of times the pink cloud is the manifestation of the grace of God. And I believe these grace periods last for specific periods of time. Depends on how sick you are. Depends how far down the scale you went. I've seen grace periods that last 2 days. If you're not working the steps in 2 days, you ain't staying sober. And I've seen grace periods go 20, 30 years. It depends upon our lack of choice in drink. My grace period, what I know about it is, it lasted at least 6 months. Because that's how long it took me to start doing, to listen to the Joe and Charlie tapes and start doing the steps.
Well, Chris, this has just been amazing. Thank you so much. Everybody will get the opportunity after the Lord's Prayer to thank you again. Let's see. So thank everybody who participated. My co-chairs, Larry, thank you as always for wrangling those questions. And if I could ask Jessica to please read the last, technically, three paragraphs on page 164.
Jessica, alcoholic. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thanks for letting me read.
All right. Thank you, Jessica. And if we could all virtually circle up and virtually hold hands, have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
Father,
who art in heaven,
heaven,
hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Whew, thank you, Chris. That was so good. Everybody's allowed to unmute.
I had a lot of fun. That's a great format.
I hope you enjoyed that. Most of the people really do enjoy it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you very much.
That was awesome.
Thanks.
Awesome,
Chris.
Thank great you, meeting. Thank you.
I got my crew here. John and Alan are part of my consistent crew. I see Luann. You know, Bob. Bob, there's Bob. He's another crew member who showed up. I want to thank them for sitting through, listening to me one more time. You know,
got a couple of grandkids here too.
And there was a cat in the room.
That would be my lucky cat.
I kept forgetting to
wonderful, very fast meeting, and you packed it chock full, so I appreciate it. God bless.